Europe is complicated. It's quality, not quantity, with Brexit. Previously in Europe, the Hungarian ambassador to the Netherlands.
Ciarán, you know what we haven't done for at least a week, possibly 2 weeks. I don't remember.
I think it was only 1 week.
It was 1 week. Talk. That's right, Ciarán. Talk about Brexit. Because we are unfortunately, for like work reasons and like needing to like feed ourselves, live in the United Kingdom, where 90%, I would say, of our news is regarding Brexit. And I think we do a remarkable job on this podcast of talking about it as rarely as possible.
I do like, I saw the argument being like, why does anyone like Corbyn? Labour doesn't have a solid like Brexit plan. I was like, because there's other pressing issues.
Yes.
It's just
yes.
The news cycle doesn't cover it.
No, it does not. And this section of this podcast will also not cover local UK things. It'll cover Brexit. Because that's the funnier part. Yeah, cool. So last week, we regarded this as not interesting enough to cover on the podcast last week, but it's continued to be ridiculous through this week, so I thought we'd mention it as briefly as possible. So last week,
think of it as a joke that lasted 2 weeks.
Think of this as like sort of a not news section, but there's some substance, and the substance is jokes. So last week, after much anticipation, David Davis, the Brexit secretary of the UK government, announced that they were going to be releasing policy papers, which they promised to do like on and off for quite a while. So they released 5 policy papers, and then a couple more, I think, after that. I think the total was more than 5, on various topics that they wanted to, that, like, you know, the idea was to be laying out their Brexit negotiating plans.
Yeah.
However, the general feedback from Brussels and people who are familiar with negotiations was that none of this made any sense or laid out actual negotiating positions. Every time I heard David Davis be interviewed, the question would always be asked of him, okay, so you want to ask for this from the EU, what are you willing to give them in return? His response was consistently, no, but you don't understand, what I'm asking for is also good for the EU, so they're going to agree to it. And then he'd say something else that was clearly only good for that was good for the UK, but also something the EU wants. And he'd say, no, that's something the EU wants. They'll have to give us something for that. And it's like, no, but that's also good for the UK. That's a weird, that's like an idiotic double standard. And stop, like, his feigning ignorance has gotten ridiculous at this point, which he maintains is a negotiating strategy.
What isn't a negotiation strategy in Brexit?
Yeah. Anyway, so Juncker, like when asked if he had read the policy papers, the answer was yes. He had read all of them, and he couldn't find any substance in them. Effectively, it was just like this was these are all pipe dreams. I don't know what the point of releasing these to the public. Their target market is a domestic UK audience. It's not substantive stuff they actually intend to, they think they'll be negotiating, or they're delusional and they think it is one or the other, possibly both. So today as of recording, or yesterday as of recording, I forget what day is today. Today's Thursday. So I think on Wednesday they had earlier this week anyway, Barnier and David Davis were giving their press conference to be like before the reopening of talks, and they kind of talked through what they'd be discussing. It kind of sounded very familiar, and then a TV reporter in the crowd shouted at them as they were leaving, sounds an awful lot like Groundhog Day. Which, you know, he's not wrong. This does seem like the podium looked similar as you would expect it to. The content of their talk was the same. They didn't actually do any negotiating that day. Sounds an awful lot like Brexit negotiations. Hey, you're on.
Yes, you.
You know who's, like, come out of his cage and is talking a lot more?
David Davis.
Yeah, but we've already done that. It's Macron! Macron! The very young man running France.
Like the way you said young.
Yes, yeah, right. Like, when Macron took office, he made this big deal. Well, he didn't make a big deal, but he had people make a big deal on his behalf that he was going to be more of a, like, not background, but as in kind of like he wouldn't have a lot of, like, contact with a large number of people in his administration. He'd have a few inner circle people who would do the communicating, and he'd make the decisions. And with that, Macron wouldn't do a lot of public statements and stuff, was the idea, and he wouldn't take a lot of questions directly to him. He described it as, or perhaps someone on his behalf described it as only, that he'd be more like a Jupiter, which I believe is a Roman emperor who did a similar thing, was kind of a, made a lot of, like, decisions, but didn't do a lot of orating, for instance. So this is kind of ended. Macron has now realized that this plan made no sense, and people kept asking questions of people that Macron would have the answer for, but the person who was giving the statement probably never discussed it personally with Macron. It was very much just a...
Added, also, like, from perspective of a, let's say, I'm potential French citizen, let's just say that.
Yes.
That sounds awful.
Right?
Like, what's the point of directly electing a president if he's not going to be directly accountable?
Well, so that's... Well, he would be directly accountable, but the people... Like, as in, the idea was to make it more efficient so that Macron wouldn't have to talk to a lot of people. Macron would have a core team who he would direct very closely, I think was the idea. But it, like, didn't really work, because then it meant there was, like... Macron was never personally explaining to the public any of his plans. We just get we'd get, like, press releases and stuff saying that things were going to happen, but it was like it was very unclear how directly invested in Macron was in any of it, and how exactly how many things that he took, like, a fine tooth comb to, and how many things were kind of like the policy wonks from his office, and Macron would never have to talk about it.
It's just weird, but, like, I kind of get the impression that he was elected on a certain level of charisma and being a bit of a fresh face to French politics. And he was like, well, you enjoyed that face for about 5 months and it's gone now.
Speaking of his face, the news to go along with that Macron is now making a lot more public statements and, you know, explaining his policies. His makeup bill from May was released, and it's €26,000. Which, considering he was specifically trying to, like, you know, be in contact with as few people as possible, what would the makeup bill have been prior? This is kind of along the theme of, like, Sarkozy always had things that he spent ridiculous amounts of money on, and were called on. It was often, like, makeup and hair and stuff. Hollande had that thing where it turned out he had a full-time hairdresser who was very well paid. Remember the scandal about his ties being very expensive?
I love his tie.
Yeah, his ties were great. They were all solid colors and expensive. Silk.
Good ties and good hair. It was good money well spent.
Well, it was money spent.
What I'm concerned is that we'll never see Macron without the makeup on, so we'll never know how much he desperately needs it.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, I mean, it's difficult in these HD television landscape.
It is.
To be a handsome young Frenchman.
To be at the time of standard definition French presidents. Dogs, all of them, but you'd never know.
Jacques Chirac never had this problem.
All right, going on to now talk about some of Macron's more substantive. That word. Kind of policy positions and stuff. A couple of things came out this week which are fairly interesting. A French article came out recently that I got translated, which is nice and handy, about his plans for European Union electoral reform for 2019. Mm-hmm. This was him speaking at the French ambassador's meeting in the Elysee. He wanted to modernize the European elections for 2019 to relaunch the Union. Anyway, He was, this kind of came up with this whole concept that he was the pro-European candidate for the election, which I think everyone's pro-European compared to Le Pen, but sure. He kind of wanted to make open nationalities lists. The idea that when you vote in 2019, there has to be at least... you just get the candidates for all the European political parties, and you have to have at least 14 nationalities represented on those lists. Yeah, but this is to solve a slight problem. Well, first, this is to... The idea behind this was to increase European unity, and the idea, like, rather than in Ireland where we talk about Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Sinn Féin, we're talking about the EPP. The SND, the same parties the people in Latvia or the people in Italy are talking about.
Yeah.
Like this kind of unity. And I'm for that. I'm a big proponent of the European parties should be the parties listed on the ballot paper for European elections, because...
There definitely is a problem where, like, beside, like, you and me know a lot, like, because we spend time reading this, but, like, I roughly know how a lot of those parties relate to each other. I tend to forget the higher level names and stuff because they're not brought up a lot. But I feel like in the news, what you end up getting is, oh, Italy wants this in the EU Parliament, and you're like, but how many MEPs is that actually, like, of is that just the majority of Italian MEPs is over, like, or is that just kind of like the ones who are related to the current government? In a similar way, you get like, oh, the UK wants this in the parliament, and you're like, are UKIP advocating for that? My impression was that they didn't advocate for basically anything, and they're like a significant number of the MEPs. So I mean, like, who are you talking about when you talk about country level things?
I feel like particularly the British coverage of this, I remember from the 2014 European elections, the British coverage is very insular.
Yes.
It would be like, UKIP has won the EU elections.
Yes.
And then, but then it was like, well, actually, no. UKIP won by one, like, they got one seat more than the Conservatives, who came second.
Yes.
And the Conservatives got one seat more than Labour, who came third. And they were all sizable chunks. They're about 20 MEPs each. But the thing is that UKIP belongs to a European party that's kind of grossly unpopular, whereas the Conservatives are relatively popular, but Labour kind of did the best because that party went into the Grand Coalition. Labour MEPs probably mean the most out of the last election.
Yeah, exactly as you said, based on, like, domestic media here, that's incredibly unclear. And, like, I'd be willing to bet that's true in a number of countries, of, like, they might restate it in articles, etc. But it would be, you would get an awful lot of, oh, this country is angling for this country is angling for that, which isn't true in a lot of cases. But I think, on the other hand, it is, because of the way the EU is structured, the national government does have extra power. It's just not... It's unclear. I think you need to...
But that's more reflective of how the national government is operating rather than how the European parliamentary elections go.
Yes. Yeah.
He wants to do this grand national list. The other kind of problem this solves, like, the European unity thing is a great thing and it's potential, but I also think you could just solve that by, like, enforcing that you put the European party list name rather than the national party list name on the ballot.
Right.
I don't think you have to do a huge amount of electoral reform to change that. But anyway, the other thing this does solve by having open, like, trans-border lists is that, for example, in our country, in Ireland, we can't vote for the ECR, which is the third biggest party in the parliament currently, because we don't have any party that represents it.
Yeah.
I would never vote for that party myself, but, like, the fact that the option isn't there is... It's kind of like this weird gerrymandering. Gerrymandering.
It's more akin to, like, if you're on a first-past-the-post system or something, and, like, that party isn't running a candidate in your constituency because they would have no hope in the first place. It's, like, it's more akin to that.
Or, like, all those people in Newcastle who wanted to vote for the SNP.
No, I think it's more like if you really like UKIP, and UKIP didn't previously, well, they did it in the last election. More like, it's more like the Green Party. You could definitely live somewhere where the Green Party doesn't run a candidate. They didn't run someone in everywhere, I don't think. Which is true of, like, and that's true in Ireland as well. Like, the Irish Green Party doesn't run a candidate in every constituency because that's not possible in a lot of places. And then it's kind of like, but I would vote for them, but I can't. And I guess maybe that's indicative of it wouldn't matter if I could.
Well, like, it would, because that, I think that kind of, he's talking about making it more directly proportional, I suppose.
Yes, yeah.
It's kind of like the issue you had in the UK's, not the general election just gone, the one before it, where about, what, 13% of people voted for UKIP, and just all those votes didn't count, basically.
Yeah.
Because of how it's structured, whereas in this system, you'd be like, okay, 13% of the parliament has to go to UKIP.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing. How well this goes, I'm not entirely certain. Macron also, just going back to what he was talking about, really heavily talked about the multi-speed Europe thing again. How he called it was like, going further with those who want to go forward without being hindered by states that want, and it is their right, to not go as fast or not as far.
Yeah, well, because at the moment there's like quite public... Because as we discussed last week, Macron was doing his like Eastern European tour of some select countries, let's say, and like currently they're like the current Polish administration, but not Poland as a whole, like in terms of all their MEPs, is on like a Eurosceptic bent, and like that would that holds up things that they would want to do that Poland wouldn't, like the current Polish administration wouldn't be for, but like. You would still get Polish MEPs voting for it in the parliament. It just wouldn't translate.
It's an interesting concept. I think looking back on these comments and what he was doing last week is kind of his attempt to avoid having a particular region of the European Union being entirely left behind.
Yes, I think that's reasonable. Or even just the perception of being left behind. Because the UK example is a good one because the conservatives don't have they're in government in like the national government, but they're by no means that do any of their MEPs relate to a party that's part of the Grand Coalition running.
They're the opposition. Yeah. They're the largest party opposition. Yeah,
yeah, but they're
same party as the Polish government.
Yeah, but they're in exactly, which a lot of people wouldn't guess.
No, they wouldn't.
Yeah, no, but so they're in opposition in the European Parliament, but like I would bet decent money on if you had a poll of people wouldn't guess that. They would guess that like they wouldn't think like UKIP's in charge, but I don't think they'd know that Labour were like the Labour MEPs are often voting for a lot of things that pass in the EU Parliament.
Yeah.
That's unclear. I think Macron's not wrong, and that's that being a problem, and like they need the perception of, well, part of the problem of what happened in the UK was that people perceived that they had no control over what happened in the EU, despite like they did, and like a lot of the arguments of like, oh, we had no control, was often people like Conservative Party people who were like, oh, we had no control, and was like, that, well, that's because you had like your party had no control because you're in a minority in Europe and you want to lower the pool to a place where you have a majority.
But you also, like, there's also situations where the Tories consented to things and agreed to things without any kind of opposition, and then just didn't make a big media circus of it.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the idea of having the, like, mention the European parties at the ballot paper allows us to rely on larger media, like, bigger media industries in other countries. So if, like, Ireland, for example, is a small country and has a limited press, isn't covering the EU elections to a certain extent, well, thanks to these like this borderless kind of system in the EU, I could then turn to German media or French media who might be covering it a good deal better.
But also at the very least, it would force media organizations in the UK, for instance, to explain the party structure.
Yeah,
because people are going to see it on their ballots and you have to be like, here's why it says all this on the ballots, is people will touch on that because it's there.
Yeah, you'd have to do that as well. That's all very interesting. I'm very curious to see if that happens. The next big thing was that Merkel and Macron actually had a kind of joint kind of statement, because he was just visiting in the neighborhood and he, yeah, they met. This is all a part of his, like, Macron's big day out. But it was on Tuesday they agreed to press forward with deeper European integration, following from Merkel's demands for a European monetary fund and Macron's proposal for a Eurozone finance minister. The fund would aim to protect the euro against any future crises, while the minister would oversee economic policy.
Yeah.
The Macron is also personally, like, this is kind of outside the arena of him and Merkel. This is, I think, just himself, is pushing for a very robust Eurozone budget.
Yeah.
He wants it to be calculated on a percentage point of the European GDP, the Eurozone's GDP. The total, he cites, like, the fact that the total tax income, member state tax income from the Eurozone last year was 10.7 trillion euro. And he's like, we should have a larger budget so we can build, not only so we can absorb shocks that hit Europe again, which I think Merkel totally agrees with, that kind of aligns with her fiscal strategy, but also so they can do more grand things, citing, like, what China, Russia, and the United States does with their budgets. Yeah, big things that European people could point to and say, that was because of the EU, that was because of the euro, kind of thing.
Another thing that I think Merkel touched on, when people were kind of somewhat insinuating that this was, that, like, this was agreeing to, like, a vast budget for, like, a Eurozone finance ministry, and it was like, well, one of the things that a small, relatively modest finance ministry could do is, if we want to start introducing, like, financial regulations that all the Eurozone countries need to implement, this could be like, well, the Eurozone finance ministry can help your finance ministry with this, and you don't have to take on all the burden of implementing these legislations, bits of legislation that we've agreed on. So, like, it keeps, like, it keeps the, like, separate fiscal policy, but, you know, builds in more assistance the EU can provide for free, effectively, with it. Not for free, but, you know, like, force people to pay their money on it.
The only thing I'm concerned about with these reforms, the electoral reforms and the financial ones, is that he's planning to get these done before 2019.
Yeah.
It seems quite ambitious.
It does. I think it's akin to his ambition to have no one ever talk to him.
Oh, no.
Now, for the second week in a row, we're going to discuss how the media, and by the media I don't mean, like, oh, that damn media, I mean, like, the poor, poor journalists whose job it is to cover this. We're talking about
this is not anger. No, it's not anger. No, this is sympathy.
Yeah. It's the German election. Where, for another week running, basically nothing has happened.
You'd think the largest, most economically powerful, most populated European Union and Eurozone member having elections would be really interesting. And on paper, that does sound really interesting.
Yeah.
But nothing's happening.
Still. I read a number of news bits and, like, opinion bits that are effectively saying, like, okay, so, like, a German election is exciting because third place is the new cool thing to be paying attention to because it's close. And you're like, I guess. Yeah. But, like, whoever that is, they'll be out of government by a very significant margin, no matter what.
who is vying for third place, if I may ask?
So like, the big ticket one to, like, you know, really, really sell those newspapers, etc., is the AfD, who are the like extremist far right anti-immigrant party. That originally started as an anti-Euro party for quite a while, and now it's
They originally started as anti-Euro, the currency.
Yes.
And then Pegida fell apart, and they hoovered up all the racists and neo-Nazis. So
yeah, which is a more tenable tenable political grouping, because I think you'll find the anti-Euro forces in Germany to be too spread out, thinly spread out. Whereas, I think, you do, like, just like in a lot of countries, you do get clusters of places that are like possibly particularly hard hit by like a refugee crisis, or conversely, like not hit at all, and therefore the idea of like more like as in somewhere of very low immigration often can tend to have like very, very anti-immigrant views due to the lack of exposure to it, or again, like, yeah, they could have too much immigration, like more so than the rest of the country, and find that unfair.
If I remember AFD's history correctly, there was a spike in their polls just after the Pegida broke apart.
Yes.
But then there was a dip in their polls afterwards when the founder of Pegida, like photos of him with a swastika shaved into the side of his head at a barber's was released. People didn't like that.
Yeah, I think this is the line between it. So like, so there's the AFD, there's Die Linke, which are considered like the far left party. Mm. So there's two relative fringe parties. There's the Liberal Free Democrats, who I don't know a lot about, but from their party name are incredibly moderate, like aggressively moderate.
Radical center.
Yeah, and then there's the Greens, who are like, you know, on green issues, they tend to gear left on a lot of stuff. So they're kind of like in a relative dead heat in the kind of like high single digits, very low teens kind of percentages. So this is why like I think I feel bad for journalists who have to, like, this is interesting, but it's not as interesting as it, like, when you're like, it's a dead heat for third place. You're like, oh, is third place going to be, like, the kingmaker? No.
They're going to be aggressively pushed out of government.
Yeah, it's kind of like all these parties are, like, they're all polling in the range where, the Bundestag in Germany has a limit of you have to have 5% of the total vote to get into the, get any seats at all. So, like, if you... Yeah, it's a very proportional system. It's not like a first past the post thing where if you have a very concentrated but small following, you could still get one or two seats. It's like you need a decent percentage of the whole population. So like the AFD have never been in parliament, for instance, and if they get in, this is the first like far right party since the Second World War to get into the parliament at all, which I think is probably one of those skewed statistics of like, oh, it's the first time X happened since X, and you could just replace it with like a lot, like an awful lot of things, and it'll still sound shocking. But because like far right is a relative term, I think, like, again, if you look at the history for Alternative for Germany, a lot of their policies are not necessarily like, well, not
Nazi-ish.
Exactly. They're probably not as well organized as the Nazis.
that's where we're going to fault them.
Sure. Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, that's effectively what people are now talking about due to lack of other substance. Because the polls are effectively unmoved with the two major parties, which like the CDU and their Bavarian counterpart, that grouping of they're in the 40s, they're like high 30s, low 40s kind of polling. Schulz and the SPD are polling like low mid 20s, so together like they easily make up like a pretty strong majority, which is they'll probably just form a grand coalition again. There's not like a closely allied small party for either of them that's doing significantly well enough that would actually bring them anywhere close to anything. And to be frank, like the parties that would get on well with the SPD running a government together, so like I guess Die Linke, maybe sort of, probably not
the Greens.
And the Greens, like even the three of them together won't hit a majority probably. So
they've talked about that before, the like far left, the supposed far left coalition, or the left coalition rather. It's not. The maths doesn't add up.
No, like, and also like getting they probably would have a lot of trouble agreeing on like a platform anyway. Like they don't agree on a lot of things. Like the SPD is very, in effect, due to their being in a very moderate government, are quite moderate in a lot of things, which is one of the reasons like the election isn't exciting. They tend to make like either misguided or very reasonable like proposals, which are often just the policies Merkel has to begin with.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, Saxony's state parliament have lifted the immunity of one of the AFD, the far-right party that we were just talking about, one of their co-leaders, I believe. This is, they're accused of lying under oath at a parliamentary election committee hearing about one of their candidates for the 2014 election. This has kind of been ongoing for a while, and this is not great news for the running up to it. So, like, in the context of the AFD, like, when you were talking about their previous poll spike, I think it was 2015, their polls hit a high of 16, which if they got 16% in this election, that would be huge. That's not that far off what Schultz is polling at, really, in the grand scheme of things. Like, that's actually very close. But kind of it's seen as they're not, like, because they didn't start out as what they are now, their party structure isn't really made up of a lot of people who agree on a lot of things. It's kind of like a lot of them are sort of reluctantly populist. Isn't really what they got into it for. It's not like, yeah, there's a lot of like a lot of these like more populist geared movements in Europe, their leaders do tend to be embroiled in corruption problems. They're under investigation for something that does seem quite legitimate because they were doing something sketchy during an election, or they were like misusing EU funds is more common. So there's that.
Why? Always why?
I don't know.
It's always that.
It is always that. That's true. Talking about the AFD very slightly more, Merkel, that, like, again, this is scraping the bottom of a barrel for things to talk about in the German election. But it's just, it's very close and it's a big deal. I don't know. Merkel was booed at a campaign rally. However, when you do look into this, so that seems like, ooh, maybe the tide's turning against Merkel. But this was in the AFD stronghold, where in the last election they got like 30% of the vote or something. So it's kind of like, well, okay, she was booed once, and of all the places for it to happen, this is probably the place it would happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, the German election. If you aren't paying attention, you haven't missed anything.
And now, Hugh, we're going to turn to a loose collection of countries that we just feel like we need to talk about.
Mm. But we didn't have enough individual stories in either of them to give them their own topic.
Yeah. Two of them are on the Black Sea. One of them isn't. And speaking about the one that isn't, this week, Hungary withdrew their ambassador to the Netherlands.
They did.
Yeah. Because I believe it's largely down to the fact that the Dutch criticized Prime Minister Viktor Orban.
Yes.
The Dutch ambassador in Budapest made critical remarks at the government of Orban. So Hungary withdrew the ambassador to the Netherlands in response.
Yep.
In a move that I'm calling childish.
Yeah, well, so, yeah, yeah. It is and it isn't. So, like, this is a guy, anyway, the guy, the Dutch ambassador to Budapest. This is days before he was due to leave this post anyway, and decided to go out in style, and or was just giving an interview and kind of said something that he didn't mean to say, effectively, like, possibly taking the view that he no longer needed to, like, tiptoe around criticizing Orban if he disagreed with the government, and he wasn't going to live in Hungary for much longer. So he made a comparison that, like, Orban's administration was effectively doing what the Middle Eastern terrorists do, which, like, whatever you think of Orban, that's not, like, if you're a professional ambassador, that's not what you do.
Yeah, that's not what you say as an ambassador.
And like, the reason you don't say it isn't because, like, you don't, like, you can say it when you've left your post, but the problem, this is what happens when you do it, like, while you're currently the ambassador to a country.
Yeah.
Like, you can't send an ambassador somewhere and then they badmouth the leader of that country, like, in kind of, you know, hard, like actual strong language. That's not the point of the ambassador. It's the point, like, you can do it personally as, like, if you're the government of a country, you can badmouth the government if you want, but the purpose of an ambassador is to have a go-between. You can't have your go-between also badmouthing Orban
saying some shit.
It's
not great. The full remark was that Sheltema.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say it's Sheltema. I do not know how the SCH sound works in Dutch.
No.
Anyway, Sheltema. So the terrorists behind last week's attack in Barcelona were losers of globalization who use extremism and fanatic religion. He added that they create enemies according to the same principle as the Hungarian government.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I get his point of using this, like, fear of the unknown to whip people up into a frenzy when there's probably a larger, more sinister economic reason that people are feeling upset.
Yes.
I totally agree with you. This is not something you say when you're employed as the ambassador. Yeah.
Entitled to your political opinions, save that for, like, the minute you leave the job.
For your nice little review with the local Dutch Gazette.
Yeah, it's like I think on a lot of levels, like, that's a clunky comparison. Like, I don't disagree with him on a lot of those points, but, like, these are not, like, I can understand his frustration, but it's, like, the exact opposite of what his job is supposed to be.
Yeah, and I mean, if you had that quote in an interview situation, I'd really be like, can you expand on that?
Yes.
Because, your description of it as being clunky, I think that's fairly apt.
Yeah, I think it's,
I think there's something there, but, you know, you need to talk about it more.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Going back to Romania. So last week we were discussing how justice minister in Romania was trying to shake up and remove politics from the judicial system and the naming and promoting of judges, which there is standing Romanian legislation to do that, and there's, like, a directive for them to do it, but they're kind of he was doing this in a way that just removed the president, who they don't get on with currently, like, the main government doesn't get on with the president. He keeps vetoing all their, like, bullshit legislation.
Tell us what you really think, Hugh.
Oh, will you expel my ambassador? So I kind of posited last week that this was a more obscure thing, like it was kind of a more insider. You need to, like, even as, like, a Romanian citizen, you need to know a sufficient amount about, like, what these changes meant and how it worked previously. Yeah. Like, it's promotion of judges isn't a clear thing to begin with.
Yeah, compared to the corruption, like, the reducing jail sentences that mostly affect people who are in there for corruption charges, this is a bit more in the weeds.
Yeah.
Or that's what we were supposing last week.
Yeah, so I was thinking that, like, this wouldn't end up with, like, the same sustained, like, protest movement that previous thing had, but there have now been protests with thousands of people in various Romanian cities. Like, Bucharest is the biggest and most notable one, which makes sense, large city, capital, etc. But there is, like, thousands of people protesting against this, because, again, this is effectively, like, they backtracked largely due to the enormous, very consistent protests for the corruption changes, and then they tried to do it a different way, and there were more protests, and they haven't done that, and the people are concerned they'll try again, and then they're trying to do another thing, which just cements their, like, hold on things effectively.
Yeah,
because there was also like in quotes and stuff, the Justice Minister has said that, oh, there needs to be, like, a way to punish prosecutors and judges for erroneous rulings and prosecutions, which is, like, that's the if you're saying like, oh, we need to take politics out of the judicial process, and you're like, oh, well, we also need like a punishment process, which I imagine he supposes would be ran by the justice ministry, is again just like it's just moving power away from like other branches of government and other individuals in the structure to the justice ministry, so that the justice minister has control over the judiciary, which is not the purpose of it anyway.
Yeah, that's fair. And just something small that we're going to cover now, because I'm particularly interested in this because I remember when construction on this began and then I kind of forgot that it was happening. But just to remind people, which I think we've done several times in this podcast, actually, the Ukrainian conflict is still very much happening. In kind of a way to solidify, well, they did this when they started construction, definitely, and just a reminder this is happening. Russia is building a bridge from the mainland Russia, the Caucasus, northern Caucasus region of Russia, to Ukraine. It's very expensive. The bridge is taller than the Statue of Liberty from water surface to air.
Yes.
To maximum height.
It's very tall.
It's a very tall bridge, very expensive bridge. A lot of infrastructure funds went into it. And yeah, it's going to connect the Crimean village of Kerch on their, what would you call it? Their eastern coast to the Russian town of Taman on the western coast of the Northern Caucasus. And yeah, this is kind of a big deal that it's now reaching the end of construction. And I remember when this was being built and I completely forgot. But it is very much like, yeah, Russia is, we've annexed this. This is definitely a power move, if you will. They have annexed Crimea.
Yeah,
we're building bridges.
This is definitely a sign of, oh, like there will be no discussion of ever giving it back. Look at this enormous, very expensive infrastructure we've built for it.
Yeah,
and this is like, oh no, like Crimea is doing great. We built them this enormous bridge. This is
yeah.
I think the general idea is this is the kind of thing that like Ukraine didn't like wouldn't have the bandwidth to like pour a load of money into Crimea, for instance, to like really, really improve infrastructure. Whereas Russia can now wire it up so Crimea is dependent on Russia for all of their electricity, because all of the electricity lines run into Russia. So like even if Ukraine was to get it back, it would be a big problem, because you'd have to like get like rebuild all the legacy systems that previously made it work that were destroyed in the interim. So yeah, there's that.
It's an unprecedented amount of money being investigated, like put into one of the federal subjects of Russia. Like they are doing this to be like, things are definitely better under Russian rule.
Yeah,
like there is no contest of this. Like this money isn't going to like Tanu Tuvu, like a part of Russia that is definitely Russia. Like
yeah, this is kind of a indication like. Russia doesn't generally have, there would be no reason to otherwise build this enormous bridge if it wasn't like recently acquired contested land. This isn't the kind of infrastructure project that would be fast tracked so quickly, if you consider like how long ago Crimea was annexed, and how enormous and expensive this bridge is. Anyway, bridges are cool. From like an engineering point of view, this is a pretty cool bridge. It's very long. It's very tall. From a
point of view, this is the most hated bridge.
Yes, it's causing lots of problems. Bridge-oriented problem.
Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. So we've built a little Facebook group called the Previously in Europe Fun Fan Group. Some people have been sending us in emails about things that we should cover. And for anyone who's done that, we are going to do that. Don't worry, it's coming. But we are trying to find ways in which you guys can communicate with us better. So yes, there's a Facebook group called Previously in Europe Fun Fan Group. We were also considering a subreddit, but that would take more effort. If you guys really want it, send us an email or let us know through the Facebook group and then immediately quit the Facebook group. Anyway, you can also find us on Twitter, Prev in Europe, at Prev in Europe, P-R-E-V in Europe. And you can email us with any concerns, any comments at previouslyineurope@gmail.com. If you like the show, please leave a review or tell your friend about it. That kind of stuff helps out a lot. Thanks for listening.